Welcome, beloved listeners, to the Little Wireless Program. Have the chances of nuclear terrorism increased in a world fearful of ISIS? And what exactly is a dirty bomb? What's the extent of the theft of nuclear materials? What are the smuggling routes? All fascinating questions prone to exaggerated reporting. We shall seek a measured response later in the program from Matthew Bunn, a professor at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. There is a rumour about the place that the rich aren't paying their share of taxes. I find that hard to credit, but there are some that take this view, and we'll be talking to two other distinguished American academics on the long history of taxing the rich. We're going to look at it around the world and various centuries. But first, last September, when Malcolm Turnbull rose from the political dead, and like the Messiah, ascended bodily, well, not to heaven, but certainly to the prime ministership, one of his first duties was to rescue a fallen angel, the political career of one of his colleagues from New South Wales. Yes, Liberal leader Arthur Synodinos, who some are calling Arthur Synodonas, he was appointed to the powerful position of cabinet secretary. Now, Arthur had been forced to quit Tony's cabinet because of the fallout from ICAC into a company called Australian Water Holdings. Synodonas has been a board member and chairman of the company, and at the same time, the honorary treasurer of the Liberal Party, a very, very busy fellow. Now, everyone awaits ICAC to report on its investigations into a wide range of matters back in 2014, but in March, another body in New South Wales, the Electoral Commission, dropped a bit of a bombshell, perhaps a dirty bomb on the Liberal Party, which could send Arthur back to the graveyard. Now, on Tuesday night, the Labor Party and the Greens got together in the Senate to have a special Senate committee into political donations, and one of its special terms of reference is to invite, or really to direct, Senator Synodinos to give evidence. Now, to discuss the politics and also the incredibly messy law on donations in Australia, we have on the blower from our home in Sydney, ace investigative reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald, Kate McClymont, and in the ABC studio in Brisbane, electoral law expert Professor Graham Orr. Welcome both of you to the Little Wireless Program. To you first, Graham. Next week's Senate inquiry, I'm anticipating some pretty good theatre. Any chance of it achieving much?
Good evening, Philip, Gladys and Kate. Not really. This is a political tit-for-tat, it seems to me, because there have been various inquiries that have hauled former Labor Prime Ministers into the witness chair. It seems to me there's far too little time and election looming for there to be any real policy outcomes of this. But I guess the Senate thinks we can inquire like a court. They always had those powers into the ethics of one of our own.
Kate, the last time we were chatting was when ICAC was doing its investigations into that wide range of matters involving both the Libs and the Labor parties. Take us back and remind us of how Arthur Synodinos got mentioned.
Well, Arthur Synodinos actually got mentioned in two inquiries, some of which overlapped. There was Operation Spicer and Operation Credo. Now, the first of those was an investigation into that curious little company you just mentioned, Australian Water Holdings. And why this was of interest to ICAC was that it seemed that even though Australian Water Holdings had only one contract and only 10 employees, rather a lot of its money, and all of its money came from Sydney Water, went into the Liberal Party. And at that time, Arthur Synodinos was, you know, deputy chairman, then chairman of this little water company, this little infrastructure company. And at the same time, he was, as you said, treasurer of the New South Wales branch of the party. But what mystified many during this inquiry was that Mr. Synodinos was not aware, he says, that $74,000 of Australian Water Holdings money was donated to the party of which he was treasurer. And at one stage, council assisting said to him, rather incredulously, I might add, does that suggest to you that you did not know that the company of which you were deputy chairman was making donations to the political party of which you were treasurer? And Mr. Sinodinos said, it was not a process I involved myself in. So that was one. And then he came back again for number two, which was just more involved in how the Liberal Party circumvented donation laws to channel money from prohibited donors. And your listeners might remember that at the end of 2009, the Labor government introduced a ban of property developers donating to the state party. But Graham no doubt will expand on this. This same ban does not extend federally. So some whizzes in the Liberal Party came up with this fabulous scheme where they had this thing called the Free Enterprise Foundation, which was originally set up to disguise people who did not want to be seen to be donating. So what ICAC exposed was a way, it was like a laundry service where donations from property developers was washed clean through the Canberra-based FEF and channeled back to the New South Wales Liberal Party in contravention to the electoral laws.
Now, Kate, these days ICAC is defending itself right, left and centre, or mainly defending itself from the right, and they seem to be finding it hard to report on all sorts of issues. Can they report on this one?
Look, they can't report on the first one, Australian Water Holdings, but they can report on Operation Spicer. And look, it may well be that it is handed down, you know, during the course of the election campaign. It might not. We haven't been given any indication, but it could be handed down at any time now.
Okay, now before we go back to Graham in Brizzy, everyone was expecting the ICAC report to be the dangerous one for Arthur, but last month this New South Wales body, the Electoral Commission, sent the Liberal Party of New South Wales a rather explosive letter. Let us open that envelope gingerly and report on its contents.
Yes, well, look, this was fascinating because the New South Wales Electoral Commission is not actually known for doing much. And so what it did was it wrote a letter to the New South Wales Liberal Party saying, guess what? You haven't revealed to us who donated $700,000 to the state Liberals in the last election. That's 2011. This is for the 2011 election via the Free Enterprise Foundation. So guess what? We're going to withhold $4.4 million in public funding that's due to you for the federal election. And you can imagine that dropped like a stone. Now, there was just a passing reference to Arthur Sinodinos in this report by the Electoral Commission. And it was just pointing out that Arthur Sinodinos was chairman of the Finance Committee at the time this money was being channeled through the FEF. And it was interesting because at ICAC, among the many don't recalls and don't remembers, the chief fundraiser, Paul Nicolau, gave evidence that he came up with this great idea at a finance committee and said, listen, why don't we channel the money through the FEF? And he said that Arthur Sinodinos was present, but Arthur Sinodinos said, look, I don't remember that at all. And if it was said, it went over my head. So he's been dragged into it, not because he's had anything to do with the recent decision whether to disclose or not, but because of his past association as chairman, as finance chairman, when this money was doing the laundromat trick.
Graham, last night we were discussing the American banking system, and my guest was talking about regulatory capture. You know, the way the regulator sometimes gets caught up, and to say to some extent, their attitude softened by their closeness to the people they're meaning to regulate. This, what Kate's describing, doesn't seem to be a case of that. Indeed, almost the opposite. For once, a regulator is throwing its weight around.
Yeah, I guess, and you're talking, I think, later tonight about the Panama Papers, and there are some interesting parallels here. We know about the hydraulics of money, especially money in politics. Money is fluid, and it's very hard to regulate private transactions. And we see this, the use of trusts, like the Free Enterprise Foundation, the paper-thin entities hiding paper trails of money. And here we have a classic case where both ICAC and the New South Wales Commission effectively stating that they think there was an attempt to avoid the law, and they say it's not been successful, as opposed to just legal evasion. And behind it all, we have this issue, I guess, of equality in the public policy behind capping and limiting political money versus the idea of money and people with wealth wanting the freedom to get around what they see as complex and inhibitory laws. But it is interesting that the New South Wales system is the one that's developing the most comprehensive regulation, and where the regulator, the administrator, who, as you say, previously they were just interested in running good, free and fair elections, but they're developing expertise, power and resources in what is a different set of skills. They're more like ASIC, auditing, policing and so on.
But Graham, one of the problems, and you've pointed this out previously, is that any discussion we have in Australia about political donations is muffled, if not muzzled, by the fact the laws are all over the place.
Yeah, what we have is pretty lackadaisical laws at the national level, and we've had report after report about what needs to be done. And what needs to be done is to look at some new dishes on the menu. It's not just enough to have some disclosure and some clean public money. We've got to look at capping contributions like many other countries. And we need limits on campaign expenditure, which are probably easy to enforce because obviously you campaign in public. And what we're getting is interesting in a federal system, this kind of experimentation and even a bipartisan approach in New South Wales to try and, it's messy, it looks messy, but they're trying to work the system a bit cleaner and clearer. But it's always going to be a cat and mouse game. We see that obviously in the United States. And we've seen a bit of this in New South Wales. So you have to look not just at the laws, but also the enforcement.
Kate, Premier Mike Baird told the Liberal Party organisation to accept the umpire's decision and admit they were wrong. Any sign the organisation or the senator have followed the Premier's advice?
Well, the senator doesn't actually have anything to do with it now that he's not he's in the federal Senate and he's not connected to the New South Wales Party. However, we're waiting to hear whether Tony Nutt is now the person designated to deal with this. And there have been negotiations going on behind the scenes at the New South Wales Electoral Commission, but we haven't heard anything more. But look, one thing I'd like to point out is that it is so vital that people disclose donations because, as you know, people so rightly, you know, would think, why would you donate money, especially lots of it? You know, it's usually to give you access. It gives you a seat at the table. You can get in the right ears. You can push your barrow. If people think that, I mean, look, some of the big companies, of course, do donate equally to, you know, both parties and say that, you know, they believe in democracy. But most people, it's quid pro quo. And at the local level, it's even more important that it's transparent. And that is the least transparent. If anyone goes to have a look at a local councillor, Liberal or Labor, and see who's been donating to their election campaign to get on the local council, you will find that both parties, there is nil to declare. And why there is nil to declare is that they're channeling donations through the head office where it becomes buried and really, really difficult to find. So that's another thing that needs looking at.
We've only got a few moments left, and I'd like to go back to you, David, with the proposition that we may, in fact, have something to learn from, of all places, the birthplace of Tammany Hall. Tell us about the New York City Campaign Finance Board.
Right. Well, for about the last 20 years, and I visited the board on sabbatical last year, they've used this funny thing called the internet to ensure real-time disclosure of donations, but also connected to a system of public funding, of opt-in caps on campaign expenditure. So a holistic system. But the main thing is we know this has been available for a long time. A very vibrant media in New York, newspapers as well as radio. That is something we're long overdue in Australia because we have a national level disclosure that will happen after this election. We won't know until at a minimum, another year and a half.
Well, donations. Kate, given the enormous difficulties you and your colleagues have had finding out who donates to politicians, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
Look, I think that real-time disclosures is the way to go, and it's something that they've got to look at. And hopefully they will at this current inquiry.
Okay, gang, thank you very much for that. Kate McClymont, investigative reporter for the SMH and electoral law expert, Professor Graham Orr from the University of Queensland. And now, after a little bit of music, let's get stuck into the rich and give them rather larger tax bills. Yet again, isn't it always, election year in Australia, so we've been hearing all about tax reform. The Coalition talks about raising the goods and services tax across the board, perhaps increasing taxes on cigarettes. Labor wants to end the super tax concession, which benefits the wealthier. Everyone agrees that negative gearing's a problem, but nobody wants to touch it with a barge pole. Meanwhile, in the US, we've been watching Bernie Sanders' campaign centred around trying to weed out the gross inequalities in the US tax system. But what does, or what might, a truly fair tax system look like, and how can we get there? Now, our next two guests have sifted through tax debates of 20 countries for the last couple of hundred years. What a marvellous idea. Looking for an answer to the question, when and why do countries increase taxes on the rich? We welcome to our little wireless program David Stavage and Ken Sheave. David is the Julius Silver Professor and Chair in Politics at New York University, and Ken is Professor of Political Science at Stanford. Their book is called Taxing the Rich, highly recommended by this little program. Taxing the Rich, A History of Fiscal Fairness in the United States and Europe, published by Princeton. And they join me now, one from New York and the other from Abu Dhabi. Ken and David, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Ken, what made you both begin this collaboration? What triggered the book?
Well, in an era with high and in many countries rising inequality and of course, also countries with struggling to fund really popular social and social programs, the question is you know, are countries ready to perhaps consider adopting higher taxes on the wealth, both to fund those programs and to address the question of higher inequality? And we thought if we looked at why countries have chosen to tax high incomes and wealth at substantial levels historically, we might learn something about the contemporary debates.
Well, I think that's become an understatement, David, because the two of you have found all sorts of extraordinary things. Your book considers income, inheritance, and other related taxes from 1800 to the present in 20 countries, heavens above. And I understand that there was a pretty energetic progressive tax system in the 19th century, but it had low tax rates, rarely exceeding 10% for the richest citizens.
Exactly. So that you can think of the world until 1914 was one where the rich, at most, in any of the countries we looked at, would have been taxed at maybe 10% on their income and no more than 15% on inheritance. So it was completely different than the world that would be ushered in by the events of 1914, where suddenly you could have tax rates, top tax rates on income or inheritance of 50, 60, or 70% even, as you had in Australia. And then what's happened in the last 40 to 50 years is that we've seen a return to a world in which the rich are much more lightly taxed than they were in the middle of the 20th century. And
you mentioned the First World War, David. Why did that trigger a bigger debate?
Well, you know, the first thing you might think is that, well, governments needed money and they needed to get it somewhere, so why not tax the rich? But what's interesting about the First World War is this was different from prior wars, in that this was a war of mass mobilization on a scale that had not previously been seen. And in a war of mass mobilization such as this, arguments were made that, well, if the poor and the middle classes were sacrificing on the battlefield, then those who had wealth ought to sacrifice as well. And so an idea was created that there should be a conscription of wealth to match the conscription of labor. And that led in many countries to the adoption of very high top rates of income and inheritance tax.
And I guess another factor at that time was the fact that the rich were becoming richer as a result, or many of them, as a result of profiteering from the conflict. Now, Ken, having looked at such a large and diverse amount of countries, what are the patterns that you see?
What we see is we see public debate about taxes in some ways. People are interested in how taxes affect their interests. They're interested in how taxes affect economic efficiency. But we see throughout the 200-year period that fairness is a really important consideration. And there's two ideas that we see in country after country and decade after decade. And one of those ideas is that, well, just like in a democracy that everybody has one vote, states should treat their citizens equally. And in terms of taxation, that's often interpreted in terms of taxing everyone at the same rate. An alternative idea out there is that, well, treating citizens equally and fairly really means inducing equal harm, and that if more wealthy and higher income citizens can afford to pay higher rates and they have an ability to pay. So these ability to pay arguments are a different interpretation of what's fair. And in times of peace, we kind of see these equal treatment and ability to pay fairness arguments competing with each other. And there's not really a consensus for taxing the rich. But in these periods of particularly mass mobilization, we see these compensatory arguments that David's talking about really persuading people who have both an equal treatment and an ability to pay interpretation of what's fair that it's okay to tax the rich at higher rates.
My guest, Ken Sheeve and David Starsavage, and back to you, David. What I find so interesting is that all the antique arguments are still alive and kicking. I'm hearing them in our election campaign. They're certainly being ventilated yet again in the US. Let's just, for example, if conservatives are willing to cop a tax, they're very fond of one of them that Ken just mentioned, the argument that everyone should be taxed at the same rate, just like everyone has one vote.
Yes, I think what's interesting about that argument is that to a lot of people who were raised to think of a tax system being a fair tax system where the rich should naturally pay higher rates, it sounds like a very foreign idea. What's interesting, though, is if you research and you conduct public opinion studies, as we have done on the American electorate, at least, if you ask people to choose between different tax systems, and then you ask people why they preferred a certain tax system, that a lot of ordinary citizens will actually use this argument that just like everybody has one vote, everybody should pay the same rate of tax. So in a sense, I think the reason why those on the political right make this argument is that for a certain segment of the electorate, a rather large segment of the electorate, it actually does resonate.
Ken, of the arguments, equal treatment, ability to pay and compensatory, which has been the most powerful and successful historically in the countries you examined?
Well, certainly it's the case that for the big innovations in taxing high incomes and wealth, it's been the compensatory arguments. Countries, in most countries, the most important factor in thinking about why we observe very high taxes on the rich are when these compensatory arguments are credible. And when those have been credible, as David points out, is during and immediately after wars of mass mobilization, in which a substantial proportion of the population has participated in the war effort.
LNL on RN, online, via streaming on your mobile, my guests Ken Sheeve and David Stasavage, who've written a book on the history of taxing the rich. Just slightly off topic, I'm just wondering how many of these arguments are currently being raised by putative presidents. And I know what Bernie Sanders has been saying and some rather insipid responses from Hillary Clinton, but what about on the right? What about on the within the Republican wannabes?
Well, on the Republican side, it's very interesting because what you do see is what you would expect. In part, it's the same sort of arguments that you're hearing on the right in Australia today. So Ted Cruz, for example, is in favor of a flat income tax system where everybody pays the same rate. And we have no doubt that the reason he's chosen that is because he knows that that will resonate with that idea will resonate with a certain segment of the electorate. But there's also some plans, some proposed tax changes that are shared by Sanders and Cruz, oddly enough. There are cases in the United States today where those at the very top of the system actually pay a lower rate than everybody else. There are various privileges linked to differential treatment of capital gains, carried interest for hedge fund managers. And we've seen proposals on both left and right in the United States campaign so far to get rid of those privileges. So there may not be consensus on whether the rich should be taxed at a higher rate than everybody else, but there does seem to be some consensus that the electorate would like to at least see that the rich are not taxed at a lower rate than everybody else.
Gentlemen, there seems to be perhaps, well, I think it's a comparatively new development. You may be able to poo-poo that by taking you back 200 years and showing it's a constant. But lately, of course, some of the very rich, like Buffett, have been saying, tax us more. Is that unusual?
Well, in some ways, it might seem a little bit unusual, but particularly, like, say, for example, in the area of inheritance taxation in the United States, it's not that unusual. Carnegie was a big proponent of taxing inherited wealth in being worried about the role of inherited wealth in a democracy and trying to find ways to equalize opportunities to succeed.
Ken, you didn't just look at democracies. I wonder what tax arguments are the most successful in less representative forms of government. Do dictators care about tax fairness?
We found some evidence that they did. And so in some of these wars of mass mobilization, you see some of the same pressures. And you can think about it in terms of if you're an autocrat, but you still need to mobilize a mass army, people have to have a sense of some degree of fairness in order to participate in the war effort to the full extent. And so what we do see is some pressures in that direction. But it is the case that, you know, the idea that fairness about is about treating citizens as equally is much more powerful in democracies. So what we observe is that in these times of wars, it's more the democracies implementing big innovations on taxing the rich than it was the autocracies that were also fighting in the wars.
David, I've got to congratulate you too on your timing. Here we have Sanders in the US, Corbyn in the UK, riding waves of disgust over increasing inequality, and also, of course, the immense dump of the Panama Papers. Is that invigorating the argument? Is that helping you and your collaborators sell books?
Well, I think what's interesting about Panama Papers so far is that there's been considerably more interest in that in the UK than there has in the US, perhaps because there's not many or any US personalities yet who have been revealed to be involved. But the real lesson of Panama Papers is that in some cases, we know in the U.S. today and in some other countries that the rich are paying a lower rate of tax than everybody else. And that's based on what they actually declare as their income and as their wealth, what tax authorities are able to actually track. But Panama Papers helps illustrate this fact that in many cases, the tax authorities don't even know how much wealth individuals hold. And so in those cases, people may be, in effect, paying an even lower rate of tax than we think, and we just don't know. And so in this environment where the public, certainly in the U.S., both Republican and Democrat, people in surveys respond saying that they think the tax system is rigged in favor of the wealthy, and I think there are similar sentiments in the U.K., that this will only augment those sentiments.
Gentlemen, I fear for you both, because you're both going to become rich yourselves because of the royalties, and of course there will be the movie. But you've done a great job, I think, and thank you very much, Daniel Starcevage, the Julius Silver Professor and Chair in Politics at New York University. And thank you, Ken Sheeve, Professor of Political Science at Stanford. The book, Taxing the Rich, A History of Fiscal Fairness in the United States and Europe, published by Princeton University Press. Coming up, terrorism and nuclear weapons. A couple of days ago, we were discussing this issue from a slightly different angle, and I made the observation that perhaps terrorism with nuclear weapons began with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I was immediately, well, not shouted down, but sternly berated by the guest. 2 days after the terrorist attacks in Brussels, a security guard who worked in a Belgian nuclear power plant was murdered. Now, the killing, still being investigated, came at a time when Belgian authorities had stripped several plant workers of security clearances. In the panic after the terrorist attacks, there was a great fear that Islamic State cells might be planning some kind of nuclear terrorism. So it wasn't much of a surprise that later, at Obama's final nuclear security summit, that threat was high on the agenda. Of course, when it comes to anything nuclear, there's a lot of fascinating and scary questions. Have the chances of nuclear terrorism increased in a world where we fear Islamic State and its tactics? What is a dirty bomb? Gosh, when I started doing this program, we were discussing dirty bombs on an hourly basis, but they seem to have been forgotten lately. Oh, what's the extent of the theft of nuclear materials and how are they smuggled out? In and out. Matthew Bunn from Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs is a global authority on nuclear terrorism. And just last month, with colleagues from the center, he published a report called Preventing Nuclear Terrorism. There's some optimism in that title, isn't there? And Matthew now joins us on The Blower from Harvard. Matthew, welcome to our little wireless program.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Matthew, before we look at the terrorism angle, what were the other issues at Obama's nuclear security summit, and was any progress made?
Well, I think there was solid progress at the nuclear security summit, but also some missed opportunities. The summit really focused on how do we make sure all the nuclear materials that you could use to make a nuclear bomb or radiological materials that you could spread over an area and contaminate it in what's sometimes called a dirty bomb, or nuclear facilities that might be sabotaged. How can we make sure they're all secure so that terrorists don't have the opportunity to commit nuclear or radiological terrorism?
Matthew, it seems only days ago that the Soviet Union was in disintegration, and there was great worry then that nuclear weapons would become available on the free market, pretty much. What are the areas of anxiety these days?
Well, we still have some leftovers from those days. It remains the case that every once in a while, real nuclear bomb material, highly enriched uranium or plutonium, shows up in the hands of nuclear smugglers. The last major case was in Moldova in 2011, 5 years ago. So this is not a hypothetical worry. This is an ongoing reality that there's stolen potential nuclear bomb material around. There's about 20 well-documented cases in the public domain, a few more in the classified world of real theft of real highly enriched uranium or plutonium. So I would argue that pretty much every country that has this kind of material on their soil, there are a couple of dozen left, has more to do to improve the security for it. On the other hand, we have made a lot of progress, really dramatic progress in Russia and the former Soviet Union. So that shows what can be done. I think over the course of the last couple of years, that progress has slowed. And unfortunately, the terrorist threat has greatly increased with the rise of the Islamic State. In terms of remaining worries, I still worry about Russia. It has the world's largest nuclear stockpiles and the world's largest number of places, greatly improved security, but still some weaknesses and serious threats from corruption, organized crime, spreading Islamic extremism. I'm actually traveling to Washington tomorrow for a meeting on the evolving threat there. Pakistan is high on my list. They have a growing nuclear stockpile and some of the world's most capable terrorists. And I'm worried about small research reactors fueled with highly enriched uranium. Australia took a major step years ago and converted its research reactor, built a new one actually, to run on low enriched uranium fuel that can't be used in a nuclear bomb. But there's still a lot of those highly enriched uranium fueled ones in a number of countries, and often with very minimal security.
Let's remind the listener, Matthew, that when we talk about a nuclear terrorist attack, we're not talking about a nuclear missile attack, but this device called a dirty bomb. Can we define this weapon or this genre of weapons?
Well, there are really three kinds of things that you worry about terrorists might be able to do. The most devastating by far would be making an actual crude nuclear bomb. Unfortunately, a number of countries, the United States and also Australia, among others, have done studies at the government level that concluded that it is plausible that if a sophisticated terrorist group got hold of the material needed to make a nuclear bomb, that they might be able to make a crude, unsafe, unreliable bomb, the kind of thing that would fit in the back of a van.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Matthew, but I also remember, you know, at the time when the dirty bomb was being much discussed, that the allegation that you could find the how-to charts on the internet.
So it is true there's a lot more information on the internet than used to be available. Not all of it is correct. But there, as I say, there have been repeated government studies that conclude that while it wouldn't be easy to do, it is plausible that terrorists could do that. So that's one kind of threat, which is an actual nuclear bomb could turn the heart of a major city into a smoldering radioactive ruin. A dirty bomb is a very different thing. You get some radioactive material that's in many places, hospitals, industrial sites. You maybe put it with some conventional explosives or the various other ways you could disperse it, and you just disperse radioactivity over an area. You create a lot of fear, disruption. You have to evacuate the area. There's an economic disruption effect, but probably nobody actually gets killed except maybe by the explosives used to disperse the material, if that's how they do it. And then a third possibility is to sabotage a major nuclear facility so that you cause an accident like the one we saw at Fukushima.
And of those three categories, it's category 2 and 3 that are the most likely.
They're the most likely, but if you think of risk as the combination of probability and consequences, I think the actual nuclear bomb is what really sort of transforms history in a profound way. And so that's why the Obama administration and the other countries participating in the nuclear security summits actually put a major, major focus on the first of those three possibilities.
And it's also, of course, one of the driving forces behind the concern about proliferation, and has been for as long as I can recall. Matthew, there was a fascinating story in the New York Times last year about terrorist groups trying to buy a substance called red mercury. And it emerges that red mercury is a myth. Tell us about red mercury.
So it's an interesting question how this all got started, but in the 90s, in these various nuclear smuggling incidents, there were smugglers who were claiming they had this material that was, you know, a key material for nuclear bombs that they called red mercury and trying to sell it for lots of money. And there ain't no such material in nuclear bombs, and it became a very popular scam idea for nuclear smugglers for a while. So this story that you refer to indicated that the Islamic State was, over a sustained period of time, attempting to get red mercury, which on the one hand suggests a certain level of nuclear interest, but on the other hand suggests, at least for those particular Islamic State activists, a complete lack of knowledge of what the real situation is with nuclear material.
In other words, a classic case of a two-edged sword. Now, even before the attacks in Brussels, Matthew, Belgium's nuclear facilities and workforce were apparently considered a security risk. Why Belgium?
Well, first of all, the United States, under its law, checks to make sure that nuclear material that the United States provided is adequately secure in countries all over the world. So, you know, a U.S. team would come every once in a while to Australia as well. Some of those checks in Belgium had raised serious concerns in the early 2000s that got up to the level of the U.S. Secretary of State calling his Belgian counterpart to demand changes if there was going to be any more nuclear material coming from the United States. But also, there have been a number of terrorist concerns in Belgium for quite some time. For example, not long after the 9/11 attacks years ago, there was a well-known soccer player, Nisar Trabelsi, who was revealed to be an al-Qaeda operative who was planning to bomb a major Belgian Air Force base where U.S. nuclear weapons are stored. And there was testimony at that trial that they had an insider at the base providing photographs and so on. More recently, in Belgium in 2014, there actually was a major reactor sabotage. So an insider at the plant at Doel 4 opened a locked valve and let all the lubricant for the turbine drain out. And the turbine overheated and destroyed itself, and they had to buy, you know, the reactor was shut down for a long time, so they had to buy alternative power as well as replacing the turbine. Total cost, something like $100 to $200 million in damages. So it's one of the biggest economic sabotages of all time. They still don't know who did it or why, it was on a non-nuclear part of the plant, so it was never a risk of releasing radioactivity. So it's at least possible it was just a disgruntled worker in a labor dispute with management or something like that. But as they were investigating, they found that 2 years before that, one of the people who was working at the plant had resigned, and the reason he'd resigned was to go off and fight for the Islamic State in Syria. And he was a person who'd actually had a security clearance to go into the sensitive areas of the plant where the equipment is that if you sabotaged it, it would cause a meltdown. And in fact, as they investigated further, they found there was another person who went off to fight for the Islamic State as well. Both of them were subsequently convicted in Belgium of terrorist activities. One of them is thought to have died in Syria. The other one spent time in came back to Belgium, spent time in jail there, I believe is now a free man. So that provoked the Belgians, to their credit, to take a bunch of actions to strengthen their protections against insider threats. More security cameras, more use of what's called two-person rule, where you're not allowed to be alone in certain areas, better access control, and so on. And then after the Paris attacks and the discovery that a lot of that network was in Belgium, Belgium also finally took action to have armed guards at its nuclear facility, which it hadn't had before.
I'm talking to Matthew Bunn, Professor of Practice at Harvard University's JFK School of Government. I accept that Russia, Pakistan, perhaps India, certainly a lot of other countries are much higher on the risk list than the US. But over the years, we've heard of a great many alarming stories, some of them emerging from within nuclear silos with, you know, with military staff perhaps getting a little bit unbalanced or terribly bored or on drugs and things. Are you confident that the American system is safe?
Well, as I said before, I think every country, including the United States, has more to do to improve nuclear security. So we had an incident in the United States in 2012, for example, where an 82-year-old nun and two other protesters in their 60s went through four lines of fencing, three of them alarmed, setting off dozens of alarms, got right up to the wall of a building with thousands of nuclear bombs worth of highly enriched uranium, were pounding on the building with hammers, writing on it when blood, pouring paint on it, and so on, singing protest songs before they were finally accosted by a single guard. And that was a major failure of what's sometimes referred to as security culture, sort of, you know, the guards and other staff at the facility really paying attention. It turned out that they had a new intrusion detection system that was setting off 10 times as many false alarms as before. The cameras that you use to check if it's a real alarm or not had been broken for months and nobody had bothered to fix them. The guards were just ignoring the alarms. The guards inside the building heard the pounding, thought, huh, must be construction. Nobody has bothered to tell us about, even though it's before dawn. Guess I won't bother to check.
You realize, Matthew, that you're going to give my listeners a very sleepless night, but let's press on. In your report, Preventing Nuclear Terrorism, you speak of complacency, not so much within the military as within the nuclear industry, being the enemy of action when it comes to dealing with the threat. So what kind of attitudes are you talking about? The dismissive belief that terrorists couldn't pull it off?
I think there's two fundamental kinds of complacency you run into very often. One is terrorists couldn't possibly do this. This is a Hollywood fantasy. Unfortunately, it's not. And I'll talk about that more in a moment. But the other is, oh, well, you know, maybe this is a problem somewhere, but my facility is secure. So there are two sets of things. Well, we recommend a number of steps to try to combat those kinds of complacencies. You know, in-depth studies and briefings on the real threat, a database of real incidents at facilities all over the world that's shared, so with lessons learned on how to prevent such incidents in the future. And realistic testing of the real performance of security. Because you can go to one of these sites and see, oh, wow, that's an impressive-looking fence. There's guys with guns. Looks pretty good. But then if you do a realistic test with capable people really thinking about how would I defeat that system, often it turns out to be much more vulnerable than you realized.
The Australian government on this very day released a new cyber security strategy, and the prospect of terrorists using cyber attacks to destabilise nuclear facilities was covered in your report. Where do you rate this threat, Matthew?
Well, I think there are two kinds of things to worry about in that respect. One is cyber sabotage, where you try to cause some kind of a meltdown or something like that through cyber. I think plants all over the world are taking steps to try to protect themselves against that. But the cyber threat evolves so fast, it's hard to know at any given time whether you're adequately protected or not. And then the other issue is cyber help to a physical either sabotage attempt or theft attempt, where, by cyber means you might unlock a door, turn off an alarm, change an accounting system so that the material doesn't look to be missing, and so on. One of the things that really concerns me about this whole picture is that in almost all of the cases where stolen nuclear material has been seized, it was never noticed to be missing until it was seized, which suggests that there may be more out there that got stolen and we never knew that it got stolen.
Looking at the market, I suppose that sort of semi-failed states like North Korea would be interested, wouldn't they, in getting some goodies?
Well, I actually worry about North Korea more as a source than as a place buying this kind of material. North Korea, unfortunately for the world, is producing its own plutonium, its own highly enriched uranium, manufacturing nuclear bombs, and so on. I think it's very unlikely that a state, especially a state like North Korea, where the whole goal of the regime is to maintain itself in power, would sell nuclear material for a bomb to terrorists because...
Well, on that happy note, I'm going to have to say goodbye, Matthew, because we're out of time. Thank you very much. Matthew Bunn, Professor of Practice at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. And it is time now to thank the other people who toil in our silo, firing off our missiles. Thank you, Anna Whitfield. Thank you, Rachel Maher, Sasha Fegan, and Ruth Slee, Tim Jenkins, EP Stan Corry, Gail's away on holidays, and thank you, Mike, for helping me up here in Muswellbrook. Stick around for the news on RN.